Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This
is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of intraretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 162, Drs. Margaret Grevin from Wake Forest University and Ali Khan from the Doheny Eye Institute join me to preview the April 2019 issue of Retinal Physician. We discuss wet and dry AMD topics, including Conbercept, vision loss in wet AMD and real-world outcomes of injections, and the mitochondria as a drug target for dry age-related macular degeneration. All articles can be found online at retinalphysician.com, and a list of financial disclosures are attached to this episode in the episode description. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be back with the April 2019 preview of Retinal Physician for this month. And joining me for this episode in alphabetical order, first, Dr. Margaret Grevin from Wake Forest University. Margaret, thanks for coming on the program.
Jay, thanks for having me.
And Dr. Ali Khan from Doheny Eye Institute, part of UCLA in Los Angeles, California. Ali, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks, Jay.
Before we start, quick shout out, Ali. We'll talk about it later, but got an email from Dr. Craig Grevin saying that we should give Ali a shout out because he said the Lakers would miss the playoffs, and they are missing the playoffs. Here as we're recording this end of March, and he made that prediction way back in like September. And I had forgotten. So Ali, shout out, kudos. But we're going to focus on the retina stuff here, and I'll ask you about that later. So the first article we're going to talk about, again, the structure of this episode, we don't necessarily summarize all the article. I'm just going to kind of talk about what the basic concept, and we'll do spin-off questions. If you want to read the articles, they're available at retinalphysician.com. The first article is the Phase 3 clinical trial, Conbercept for Exudative AMD. Subtitled, the drug has the potential for extended treatment effect. This is written by Dr. Priya Sharma and Dr. Jeff Heyer out of Boston, Massachusetts. And essentially what they looked at in this article, they just kind of, again, summarized macular degeneration, the treatment options and the targets, talked about the history of Conbercept and its approval in China, and then the Aurora trial, which looked at two different doses for Conbercept and summarized the results, as well as the Phoenix trial. Once again, looking at Conbercept. And Conbercept has been used in China, and there are now the PANDA trials ongoing, which are looking at the use of Conbercept on a larger scale. And I'm going to start with Ali. You know, Ali, how much, first of all, I mean, Conbercept is something we have heard about in the United States. China's been using it for some time. We'll hear about it at the meetings when we go to it. I mean, how much have you heard about Conbercept? Obviously not available to us in our clinical practice. And based on this article, what sort of impact do you think it may have on our treatment regimens?
Yeah, I think you know, going to retina meetings, you've heard of it. I mean, it's been used in China since 2013, so about 6 years of practice there. So there is quite a bit of quote unquote real world data from China, but I think everyone was just sort of waiting for the larger phase three global trials before it would be available in the U.S. So at least in my mind, I was sort of just keeping in the back of my head, but not really thinking about it much until it would actually be available for us. But I think the article does a good job of explaining what evidence is currently out there, and also describing the PANDA trials, but also just talking about what is Conbercept from a molecular point of view. So I thought it was just very similar to aflibercept, which it is, but it is a bit different in that it's supposed to have a higher binding capacity, longer half-life, and also binding VEGF-C in addition to VEGF-A and VEGF-B, which aflibercept have. So it is kind of a different molecule. So I am interested to see how it performs in the phase three studies. But just like any of these AMD trials, I think the burden of proof is high. I think in the PANDA trials, the phase three studies that are ongoing, they're comparing it to aflibercept every 8 weeks, and it's a non-inferiority study. So, you know, if it's the same as aflibercept or non-inferior, then I don't know if it's going to change much from my point of view, because it's just another agent. But if it shows that it's more durable or has some other effect on morphology, then I'd certainly be interested in using it if that bears out.
You know, one of the things you referenced, Ali, that we've spoken about on the air is, again, the burden of proof. If you do need to design a drug for wet macular degeneration, you need to essentially feel some sort of need or offer some sort of benefit over current therapy. So, Margaret, you know, in your practice and with the patients you treat with wet macular degeneration, what do you think kind of the biggest areas of need for the patients you see? Like, so we have treatment that does work, but for a drug like Conbercept or other things we're going to talk about, I mean, what are some of the biggest holes that need to be filled in terms of our treatment regimens?
Well, I think the two major ones are efficacy, Jay, and durability. So, I mean, a major issue for all of our patients is having to come in for monthly injections. And if we could find some way to extend the duration of action of these drugs even somewhat, then that would be a huge benefit to our patients. And then, you know, as we're going to talk about in some of these other articles, you know, we target the VEGF pathway pretty well now. And yet, despite that, you know, some of our patients continue to lose vision. So there are other things at play. So I think those two things are needs that need to be addressed. And I think that the PANDA studies, I mean, the design is interesting, and it's, you know, in the PANDA 1 study, they're comparing 1 milligram dose every 12 weeks just from the get-go after 3 monthly injections. So if that is as effective as aflibercept, having, you know, something that's equivalent to aflibercept every 8 weeks, that would be, I think, a major, not major, but it would potentially make this a drug that we would, you know, maybe want to switch to in some of our patients. And then in PANDA 2, they're actually at week 40, they switched to PRN treatment for all of the arms, and they're capping it at 16 weeks, which, you know, right now, my treat and extend regimen, I usually stop once I get to 12 weeks, but it's pretty ambitious, I think, and exciting if it does show the results that they're hoping that it will show. I guess we're all hoping it will show.
Yeah, and Margaret, one of the things you referenced was that in terms of needs, again, in two of these articles we're going to talk about in a minute, talk about our options are good, but they're not perfect. And one of those articles was written by Roy Schwartz and Usha Chakrabarty, which was Why Vision Loss Persists in AMD, and the subtitle Exploring the Reasons for Decline in Treatment Patients. You want to just tell us a little bit about the sort of things that they discussed in terms of why patients with neovascular AMD who get treated still can lose vision?
Yeah, so I think sort of two major things that potentially can lead to vision loss in our patients in the real world are under treatment. So persistent fluid and patients not being treated as often as they are potentially in the clinical trials, and then progression of atrophy. You know, in the 7UP study, I think all eyes in the 7UP study had progression of atrophy compared to when they were initially enrolled in MARINA and ANCHOR. And, you know, atrophy is not something that's addressed by our anti-VEGF injections. So that's a big part of it as well.
Ali, how about your thoughts? I mean, again, this is similar to some of our long-term data for other conditions, for example, vein occlusions, where it's a little sobering to kind of look at where we go with these patients over years. What do you kind of tell your patients when they say when they start injections, what to anticipate in terms of vision over time?
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, this article and one of the other articles we'll discuss just talk about how, you know, real world outcomes don't seem to match up with the clinical trials, and maybe why is that? And I think, you know, we have long term data from the CATT trial, 7UP, like Margaret mentioned, that show that the vision does tend to decline over time. And, you know, I tell patients, yeah, we have these drugs that are great at sort of keeping your vision as good as possible, but it's still a condition that does get worse with time. So it's not something that we could say you won't lose any vision, but the sooner we can get you under control, the better chance we have at that. So tell them that, you know, even with these injections, obviously we have to keep following you and just making sure that things stabilize, and try to give you the least number of injections as possible while keeping your vision good for the longest period of time. So I do sort of frame it as, luckily we do have something that works really well, but it's still a matter of disease control, not a disease cure.
Well, and before we get into that real world article, which I'll have you describe, Ali, without references to The Real World, your favorite TV show. I was about to ask you your favorite version, but you may not have one. But anyway, so tying back to this discussion, right? So, like, one of the things I think it's interesting that we've seen over the course of our training and now that we're out in practice is there's been kind of this swinging pendulum about how much to treat these patients, right? I feel like at the beginning it was we should be treating these patients very frequently, don't tolerate fluid, you know, keep treating them. Then there was the question from the CATT study was, oh, if you overtreat these patients, do you progress to atrophy? And the pendulum's kind of swung back and said, well, maybe that's not from the medication. We're not sure. Maybe that's just the natural progression of the disease. And some of the real-world data is saying, well, they're losing vision. Maybe we're undertreating them. And then we have data that says, well, maybe fluid isn't that bad. We've talked about trial papers here on the program, the fluid study, for example, where fluid can be tolerated. It doesn't seem to affect vision, at least in a short term, quote unquote, for AMD, like in 2 years. So I'll let Margaret start, but I mean, where do you guys see this pendulum shifting, right? It's really hard to know where it's going to go. I mean, how do you guys approach your AMD patients? When do you start extending them? Do you think that as a group that we're undertreating, overtreating, or kind of just right based on the data we've seen?
Yeah, I mean, I think based on the data that we have available, I think there's a pretty strong suggestion that in the real world, we are undertreating our patients. And I think that, for example, in Horizon, patients were receiving 2 injections the first year that they were enrolled, 4 injections or something on average per year after that. In 7UP, it was like in the first 6 months, only 60% of patients got any injections at all. So I think we probably are undertreating our patients. And the data in those studies also, you know, show that a lot of the patients had active exudation. It wasn't that they were dry and they weren't being treated. They actually had signs of leakage. So I think that we probably are undertreating our patients. I'm usually pretty aggressive with my macular degeneration patients, and I treat monthly until the fluid resolves. And if it doesn't resolve, I keep treating monthly if the patients will continue to come in monthly. And then I start to extend them when I'm able to get them dry. And then I think it's always a discussion with patients who have advanced atrophy, but still have active exudation and their vision is limited by atrophy, whether or not to continue injections. And I think that a lot of that depends on patient-specific factors, like their needs and the vision in the fellow eye. But in general, I'm pretty aggressive.
Well, and Ali, I'll ask you your thoughts, and maybe you can tie into telling us a little bit about this real-world outcomes of anti-VEGF therapy in neovascular AMD in the United States article by Thomas Chula. I mean, you can maybe talk a little bit about what he described, and then maybe kind of your thoughts on the same issue.
Yeah, so the article by Dr. Chula describes kind of a real-world outcome study that he led in the United States. So there is called the Vestrom Health Retina Database. So it's a kind of a conglomeration of data from multiple EMRs from U.S. retina specialists showing, you know, real-world outcomes of wet AMD treatment in the United States, regardless of, you know, initial drug or what their status was at the time that they were treated. And again, he sort of echoed the article from Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Chakravarti saying that our real-world data is not as good as our clinical trial data, and sort of offered some reasons as to why that might be. One of the main reasons being under treatment, he mentioned, and also that in the real world, we sometimes, you know, inject patients that are much worse at outset. So a patient that would not be really eligible for clinical trial, and thus that might be clouding the results as well. So kind of going back to what Margaret was saying, I treat very similarly to what Margaret does. So I start monthly until they are dry. If they are not getting dry, I'll switch agents until, you know, usually give at least four to five injections per drug to see if it's working before switching. But if they are dry, then I do use treat and extend rather than, say, a PRN formula and go from there. I think that the hard part is Margaret alluded to, is if you have a patient who has, say, atrophy or subretinal fibrosis from prior untreated macular degeneration, and their vision's already pretty bad, and you get them dry and their vision's still bad. So from whatever reason, the atrophy or fibrosis, scarring, their vision did not improve. So you can make their OCT look better, but that's the point where I sort of have a discussion with the patient, you know, do you still want to continue on doing this? Obviously, we're not going to let you get worse. But if your vision is not getting better after a certain amount of time, can we back off? And I think that leads into the under-treatment that you might see from these real-world studies. I don't think it's necessarily appropriate to treat monthly on someone whose vision is not improving at all and has a big area of fibrosis underneath the macula. So I think that's where our real-world data and clinical trial data probably appropriately doesn't match up.
Well, I think that the status of the fellow eye, as you alluded to, is super important, right? So like if you have somebody who's 2400 or count fingers with a discoform scar when they see you and they're active, I mean, I always offer treatment to those patients. I have the conversation with them that, look, this is active, but I also talk that the prognosis with our current treatments isn't great. I'm willing to try for a little bit, but I really like stay on them to see if there is subjective improvement, assuming their other eye is okay. Let's say they have good functional vision in their
exactly.
other eye.
Yeah.
I think where it gets tricky, like you guys talked about, is if someone already has a disc-form scar in one eye, now they're 2200, 2400, you know, and we've all seen this. We have patients who are very specific that their vision does improve with the injections. They know exactly when it wears off. And you might say, well, the visual Snellen visual acuity isn't changing, but they can kind of tell when they're more active. I think the tricky part, and I think the part that always worries me with AMD, and I tend to be aggressive, as you guys alluded to and Margaret said, is we know that you can tolerate the fluid, but what does the fluid mean in terms of risk of vision-threatening subretinal hemorrhage? Like, I think that's the hardest mm-hmm. part is, like, if you have fluid there, we know you can tolerate some subretinal fluid, but if there is fluid, I'm always really hesitant to extend them more because I think that's a sign that it could be an active CNVM. And again, the incidence of subretinal hemorrhage that's going to drastically affect the vision isn't super high, but when it happens in someone, especially if it's their better eye and their other eye doesn't see well, it can be really devastating to them on a functional level. That's the hardest thing that I think that we don't have awesome data on preventing that, because it's not necessarily the most common complication, but we just have to think about it, because when it does happen, it's a total game changer. Because even though we do have treatments mm-hmm. of subretinal hemorrhage, including anti-VEGF or displacement or pneumatic displacement, subretinal TPA with vitrectomy, the outcomes in AMD, regardless of the technique used, aren't consistently good. So I don't know. I don't know. How do you guys kind of balance that risk in your head when you see these patients? Margaret?
Yeah, I mean, I think you raise really great questions. And like you said, you know, massive submacular hemorrhage is visually devastating. And oftentimes, you know, vision doesn't recover. And so it's something that we have to think about. You know, I think I was just thinking as you were talking, another group of patients that I struggle with for a similar reason is patients who you've been treating on a regular schedule. And then they are lost to follow-up for whatever reason. They go in the hospital, they go on a trip, they just don't come in. And then they come back in 6 or 9 months later and they don't have any leakage. And it's like, well, we were treating you monthly or whatever. And now, I mean, should we just do PRN treatment? We know that you have active leakage in the past. And I think, again, the thing that you worry about is that, you know, they could recur with a vengeance. And so, you know, I always have a conversation with those patients about whether we should, you know, just start back doing, you know, an extended interval or watch them closely, especially initially, to see if they have any evidence of recurrence.
And Ali, I mean, I'm curious your thoughts, but I think the other thing that we're finding, I mean, as we get more technology, we've referenced OCT and GRR, for example, show CNVM sometimes, but there's an absence of leakage. And there's some data starting to come out, but we need long-term data. And for example, that patient Margaret talked about, let's say you do an OCTA and see a CNVM, but they have no fluid. We don't know what that means in terms of future risk, prognosis, whether you should treat them. So that definitely is a tough situation.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a good problem to have, I guess, but we sometimes have too much information. Like, you know, we have so many options, we have so many imaging modalities, so there are these kind of questions, and I guess the easy answer in kind of a busy clinic is to either keep injecting monthly or just do treat and extend. So, you know, there is that, but, you know, the kind of scenarios that just don't seem to add up, like a patient who didn't have an injection for 9 months, like Margaret said, but is still dry. You know, that is someone I usually have a discussion. Okay, we can watch you closely, do PRN, as long as you understand the risk that if it comes back, it could set us back. And so, you know, you kind of pose it to the patients. I think I have some patients who would just prefer to ride it out and just prefer not to get injections and hope for the best. And others who from having a family member with wet AMD or have kind of a very, you know, visually demanding job, that if something were to happen, it would certainly put them out of work, that they prefer, no, I'd rather restart injection. So I think, you know, posing the question back to the patient sometimes can help. I don't know if there's a right or a wrong answer, you know, depending, you know, if you go by Marina and Anchor and those kind of monthly trials, I guess the right answer would be best vision is with monthly injections, but I don't know if that's necessarily realistic for a lot of patients and necessary for a lot of patients. So we'd like to generalize as much as possible, but sometimes I think we got to go case by case.
I mean, the final kind of unturned or niche that needs to be filled in AMD, and Margaret referenced at the beginning, we talked about durability and efficacy. We also have patients, there's a small subset of patients, you know, somewhere depending on the paper between 5-15%, who just have persistent exudation despite consistent anti-VEGF treatment, regardless of agent, right? And those are the patients who we find creative ways to treat. And those are the ones I think that are frustrating too, where maybe on a Q4-week regimen, you're just skating by, but there's always a little bit of fluid. If you try to extend them at all, it recurs. You try a different agent, it's worse. I have a couple of patients, for example, getting aflibercept every 4 weeks that I really can't extend. And there are other creative ways people have thought of to try to treat them. Topical dorzolamide timolol, like Dr. Xu and I published years ago, that doesn't work in everyone, but it can work. PDT, like blast from the past. People have tried steroids, topicals. I mean, what do you guys typically do in that scenario if you have somebody? And again, the obvious thing is make sure that they don't have central serous retinopathy or something that is not AMD and it's a misdiagnosis. But assuming they do have AMD that's with persistent fluid, how aggressively do you chase that if they're on a Q4 interval, and what do you do? Margaret?
Yeah, I mean, those are the most challenging patients. So, I mean, assuming that they still have active exudation and I've tried all three of the available anti-VEGF agents, then, it depends on, I think, their vision, the vision in the other eye, and whether the fluid is stable or if it's worsening. So I think if it's worsening and they have pretty good vision, then I'm worried that their vision is going to drop off and we're going to lose ground. And so in those patients, I usually recommend PDT. And then in the patients where they have maybe a small amount of subretinal fluid, it's stable, their vision's okay, it's holding steady, then I'll probably just continue treating them monthly and just try to hold things where they are.
Yeah, the last article, just to kind of shift gears into dry AMD, which we've talked a lot about recently in the podcast, that different things are in the pipeline. Obviously, there's no proven FDA therapy that's been shown to either reverse or stop the progression of AMD, though we do have the AREDS vitamins that slow. And this is an article written with Dr. Barry Cooperman from UC Irvine as the senior author, Mohammed Riaz Eshafani as a first author, about mitochondrial repair in dry AMD, and just talking about how dry AMD may be potentially treated with some things that target the mitochondria DNA, and this may be a future area of targets. I mean, again, I'm not going to get into the specifics. It's a very well written, but I think that the take-home point, right, is, again, going back to what Ali said regarding wet AMD, the burden of proof you need to have a drug that does get approved or show efficacy. For dry AMD, it's a kind of a different challenge, right, Ali? It's not that there isn't treatment available. It's just that you have such a slowly progressive disease in general that the amount of follow-up and kind of how to measure what you're trying to treat, it's not like as simple as wet AMD. It's like, okay, how many lines of visual acuity did you gain with this injection?
Right. Yeah. I think with, dry AMD, we just sort of watch it. Some people do fine, but it's these people who progress to atrophy relatively quickly, even over the years, who, it's hard because we don't have an injectable or something that could help them at this point. And any recent studies on, our recent trials haven't really panned out in phase two and phase three for dry AMD. So I think the purpose of this article is saying, maybe we need to look somewhere else, and sort of the interplay between mitochondrial DNA and cellular DNA has some potential therapeutic targets to help prevent RPE cell death and fibrosis. So I think, like a lot of things for dry AMD, the science and the basic science behind it actually seems very compelling and seems convincing, but how it actually plays out clinically, I think, is the tough part. So the article talked about an interesting model, cell model they have, kind of using the same RPE19 cell line that is often used in basic science research for retina, but then infusing per se those cells with mitochondria from different people, different populations, and seeing how the cells then later react to different stimuli, like reactive oxygen species, et cetera, to see how they survive. So I'm convinced from the article that it's definitely worth looking into, and I'm interested to hear what research comes out of it. But unfortunately, it still seems quite basic right now in terms of the level of research. But I think mitochondrial DNA research is a hot topic, not just in retina, but elsewhere. So hopefully something does come for it.
Margaret, your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, this is something that I had not ever really thought about, but it's a very good review of mitochondrial DNA, and as well, all of a number of different potential targets that have very preliminary basic science research supporting a potential role in RPE cell death. And so I think it highlights a number of interesting potential targets, but it remains to be seen how these will play out and if they will play out in our clinics in the future.
Well, Dr. Ali Khan, Margaret Grevin, thanks so much for doing this with me. Quick hitting topic discussion of these AMD articles. Before we go, a couple bookkeeping notes. First of all, and again, time goes fast. I mean, it's had Dr. Donaldson manually, longtime Wells attending, passed away in January. Margaret and Ali are both former chief residents at Wells, both knew Dr. Manley well. I don't know if you want to say a few words, and I'm going to let Ali go first because age before beauty. Sorry, Margaret.
Well, definitely correct in that description. But Dr. Manley was, for people who didn't know, was a pediatric ophthalmologist. He was integral in the pediatric retina service or pediatric service at Wills for decades. And even when most people would have retired, he still attended in our ER and was very, very helpful, as Margaret probably will remember, for strabismus cases in particular, and had a great interest in videotaping strabismus cases for the purpose of resident teaching and really took an interest in the residents. So a very, very, very nice man who lived a long, productive life. So definitely someone will miss, not just at Wills, but I think in the pediatric community in general.
Yeah, I would definitely echo all that Ali said. Dr. Donaldson Manley was an amazing teacher, and he really dedicated his life to teaching residents and was so passionate about motility disorders and pediatric ophthalmology. And he was an amazing asset to us as a teacher at Wills, and he will be very missed.
Well, guys, this is Dr. Manley, I didn't know as well, but very, very gentlemanly man, and saw him as the ER attending. And what was amazing about him is that when they needed ER coverage on the weekends, before any of the fellows, before anyone, Dr. Manley was the first one to say he would come attend in the ER Saturdays, Sundays, whenever, any night. You know, he was very, very dedicated to the residents as someone who came as an outsider, as a fellow. So he will be missed. And again, the whole Wills family misses him. Well, and guys, before we go, this is rare where we actually are recording an episode that's going to come out relatively soon. Like normal times, we're recording these episodes, Ali makes some prediction, and then 6 months later, the episode comes out. It's totally dated. But yeah, this episode is going to be coming out right before the VitBuckle Society weekend, which is next week. I'll see both of you there. I'm looking forward to it. And again, tying to the Wills family, Carl Ruggiello receiving the keynote interview award. I'll actually be interviewing him there. And you guys also obviously know Dr. Ruggiello while he's been on the program. We can say lots of nice things about him. He's a great mentor, teacher, and surgeon. But yeah, you guys, I'm looking forward to the meeting, seeing you guys there. Ali, you're going to be there Friday through Sunday?
Yeah, that's the plan for now.
Margaret, you the same, or are you going to come in a little earlier?
I get in Thursday night.
Well, we're going to have a ton of fun Thursday night before you come, Ali, and then we're not going to hang out with you after that. Well,
thanks,
I'm excited to see y'all.
That's how it is, Ali. Well, last things before we go, Ali, March Madness episode coming out 4 days from now. It'll be at the end of this weekend's games. You're going to pick a team. Margaret's going to pick a team too. Who's going to win the title?
Heels.
Wow. Margaret didn't hesitate. Ali?
Yeah.
Can you pick the Heels as a Wake Forest alum? Can you pick North Carolina? Is that even allowed?
That's totally allowed.
Is the hierarchy?
I went to Vanderbilt undergrad. You know.
That's true, but like I go. Definitely not Duke though. You're not picking Duke.
Not Duke. Nope.
Ali?
I don't know, I'm upset because the Pac-12 is just not really doing well, period, in sports these days. So honestly, don't really know. I think the money's on Duke. Just they got played pretty hard by UCF.
No, they should have lost that game. That was so sad.
They should have lost, but that's how it works. So I think they might have got their wake-up call and now they're focused. So we'll see what happens. But I don't know. The money's on Duke, but I'd still take the field right now.
And last thing, Dr. Craig Grevin wants to know your thoughts on the Lakers going into this summer and next season, since you seem to be Lakers Nostradamus.
It's a mess. I think I called it. I think LeBron coming was going to be this magic fix. Everybody's injured. Ball and Bland is gone. So I don't know. I think they got a lot of work to do for the team, chemistry-wise, free agent-wise, and otherwise. So I think it's going to take quite a bit of work. And just trying to go after Kawhi Leonard or something like that is not just going to be the answer. So we'll see. I think it's going to be another couple years, and maybe LeBron's third year we get back into it.
You know, there's a couple of crazy stats in basketball. One of them I saw recently was that the Spurs have only spent 65 days with a losing record in the last 20 years, which is pretty insane. But the other one we've heard is the Lakers only missed the playoffs like four times in like their first 60-something years of existence, right?
Yep.
And now they're going to miss the playoffs multiple years in a row. It's crazy.
Yep. I mean, it's been rough. We had it pretty good for a long, long time. But, you know, still got some catching up to do. And LeBron coming is not going to fix everything. So that's how I still feel about it. I'm still in the LeBron skeptic side of life for Lakers fans, but I'm hopeful still for another couple of years.
Well, Margaret, Ali, thanks so much for joining me, and hopefully we'll get to hang out next week.
Sounds great. Thank you, James.
Bye, guys.
As always, you can find this episode, all prior episodes, on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. All the 162 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You'll find our blog, Equal Ground Reactive Lessons from Pupils. There you can find weekly blog posts by one of our two great medical students, Mike Venikos and Amy Klusterbohr, where they reflect on the latest episode and offer their perspective. On the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the Apple Podcast Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us at the Apple Podcast Store or Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and do contact us. Click on the contact us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Feedback is the lifeblood of what we do. We love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we're already doing well. We also appreciate anyone who subscribes via iTunes or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Grevin and Khan for joining me today. Thanks to Dr. Louis Kai and Angela Chang for producing a great episode. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you help inspire here each episode. I hope to see many of you at the Vitbuckle Society annual meeting this weekend in Las Vegas. We'll hopefully have a recording from the meeting up early next week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.